Content warning. This episode discusses sexual violence, domestic violence, and criminalized survivorship. If you or anyone you know needs help, please safely consult the resources in our show notes.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Nikki's case encapsulated everything that's wrong with the way the criminal justice system treats survivors of domestic violence. The prosecution was based on every imaginable myth about the impact of domestic violence and the ignorance of the district attorney about how survivors of domestic violence, quote, should act, quote, was just throughout the case.
Hello, and welcome to The Hearing, a legal podcast where we have insightful conversations with interesting people connected to the law. I'm your host, Jennifer Thibodeau. In honor of Domestic Violence Awareness Month in the United States, I sit down today with Garrett Beeney, a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell, to discuss his pro bono representation of Nicole, Nikki, Adamondo, and the issue of criminalized survivorship. Garrett shares Nikki's story, that of a young mom who suffered years of repeated physical and sexual abuse by her domestic partner, who was the father of her two small children. She fatally shot him, and as Garrett explains, the abuse that Nikki suffered at the hands of her abuser was then repeated throughout the criminal justice system, resulting in her lengthy incarceration. Garrett shares why he got involved on the appeal and the uphill battle to free Nikki. You'll hear about the legal and scientific arguments he and others made to address compound errors and, frankly, ignorance. And as he explains, thankfully, the appellate court rejected the trial court's arcane and antiquated impressions of how domestic violence survivors should act. And Nikki is now home with her children. We'll talk about what we each can do to educate ourselves and others about domestic violence and criminalized survivorship and how we can help. And now, my conversation with Garrett Beeney.
The Hearing.
Hi, Garrett, and welcome to The Hearing.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. You are a partner at the global law firm of Sullivan & Cromwell, where you co-head the firm's intellectual property and technology group. But you also devote your time, talent, and resources to pro bono work. And here in the United States, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So we are here today to talk about your representation of Nicole, Nikki, Adamondo, and the issue of criminalized survivorship. So, Garrett, can we start by hearing a little bit about Nikki's story, the events of the evening of September 27th, 2017, and the events leading up to it?
So, Nicole Adamondo, who, as you mentioned, Jen, goes by Nikki, is a 36-year-old woman who, thankfully now, is living north of New York City with her two children, a son, 11, and a daughter, 9. Like many survivors of domestic violence, Nikki had a childhood that was marred by sexual abuse. And I should note that, you know, everything that I'm going to talk about is public. I'm not revealing any of Nikki's secrets, much of which were related in a book that her sister wrote, which maybe we can talk about in a bit. Nikki was raised in Dutchess County, also north of New York City. Her mother passed away from cancer in 2019. And I think like many survivors, Nikki's education, if you will, in her household was to learn passivity in response to unwelcome sexual advances. Nikki went to Dutchess County Community College on a full scholarship. She received a BS in early childhood education to follow her passion, which is really to be with young children. She taught nursery school until the birth of her son in 2012, and then her daughter was born 2 years later. She is and was, by all accounts, a loving and caring mother in support of her case in a variety of contexts. People wrote things about Nikki that included, and now I'm quoting from some of these letters, Jen, "She created the most beautiful child-centered home on barely any budget. Also, her kids could feel safe and seen. You can feel the love and support seeping from every bone in her body. I know Nikki to be a loving, selfless, compassionate, intelligent, educated, and peaceful mother and friend. She is a mom whose kids are her world, and everyone could see that when you looked at her." And those statements go on and on and on. Nikki first met Chris Grover in 2008. The first instance of what Nikki refers to as non-consensual sex, Nikki always avoids using the word rape, occurred in 2011. The abuse and the rapes got worse after Ben's birth in 2012. And over the next 5 years, Nikki suffered horrific abuse at the hands of Chris Grover. Burnings, whippings, beatings, posting of pornographic videos and pictures, things that you just really can't imagine that one human being would inflict on another. And they were all documented either by law enforcement or by medical service providers who Nikki had to visit regularly because of the extent of the abuse. On the evening of September 26, 2017, Child Protective Services called Nikki's home to say that they had had reports of abuse and wanted to visit the home. Nikki had always tried to avoid any kind of public discussion of or indication of the abuse, fearing in large part that it would result in the one bright side of her life, which was her children, being taken away from her. Grover had always told her that no one would believe that he was abusive, given his public persona in the community, and always told Nikki that if she ever reported the abuse, she would lose her children. So the next day, when Child Protective Services arrived, Nikki denied the abuse. When the children hinted at it, the social worker wrote to Nikki, "Are you safe?" And Nikki said that she is safe. That night after Child Protective Services left, Nikki had the courage to say to Grover that they should take a break, that no one will know about the abuse, and she pleaded with him just to let her and the children go. Grover's response was to get his gun, load it, and tell Nikki that he could kill her when she was sleeping. Then he would kill himself and the children would have no one. Later, we learn that Grover's phone was not only full of searches for violent pornography, but also searches for how he could kill someone and make it appear to be a suicide. That night, that is the night of September 27, Grover took Nikki's phone. He raped her. The rape ended up waking up Nikki's daughter, who she then went in to comfort and put back to sleep. When she came back into the living room, Grover was lying on the couch. He told her to lie with him. When Nikki thought he was asleep, she tried to get up. Grover awoke, pointed his gun at her. They struggled. The gun fell to the ground. Nikki picked it up, pointed it at Grover. Grover said that she would never do anything about it and that he was going to then kill himself and her. They struggled when he approached her and she shot and killed him. She gathered the children, went to the car. When she was stopped at a red light, there was a police cruiser behind her just by happenstance. And when she didn't move when the light turned to green, the police officer got out and Nikki told the police officer the whole story, as she did multiple times to law enforcement, consistently, never wavering, always admitting that she had shot Grover, but also telling about the horrible abuse, which, as I mentioned, is well documented in medical reports.
You know, Garrett, I have heard Nikki's story. I have read about it. I have heard her tell it in snippets and television interviews. Every single time in hearing you today, it just leaves me speechless. It is so unbelievably tragic. And we haven't even touched upon what happened next. So what happened?
So the abuse that Nikki suffered at the hands of Grover was just then repeated in the criminal justice system.
Mm.
Like many survivors of domestic violence, Nikki's case was approached through ignorance of what we know about the science of domestic violence, and really a horrendous single-minded direction to try to convict Nikki rather than try to secure any form of justice. So Nikki's case was presented before a grand jury. She was indicted for unlawful possession of Grover's gun and for second-degree murder for premeditated killing of Grover. She was tried in front of a jury in April of 2019. The trial lasted almost 5 weeks. Nikki testified at length about the abuse, although her rendition of the events was really truncated as a result of legally erroneous evidentiary rulings by the trial court at the urging of the district attorney to keep evidence away from the jury that would have confirmed Nikki's story about the abuse. And after the trial, the New York had passed and Governor Cuomo had signed into law something called the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act, something that the legislature recognized that really fit Nikki's case to a T, that survivors of domestic violence should not be treated just as any other criminal in the criminal justice system because of the impact of domestic violence and what science now tells us is the impact of domestic violence on the brain and physically in other cases. According to the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act, if a defendant is a victim of domestic violence, if the domestic violence was a significant contributing factor to the crime for which the survivor has been convicted, and if under the circumstances the law would impose an unduly harsh sentence, the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act provides for a reduced sentence. There was a hearing on Nikki's application to be sentenced under the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act, the first in the state, and the judge declined to apply the act, even though, as amicus brief we submitted in the appeal, pointed out that the act was passed exactly for people like Nikki. The judge found, again, showing his palpable ignorance about the impact of domestic violence, that Nikki could have just left and taken her children without any kind of understanding of where she would go or the things that happen with domestic violence that prevent survivors from leaving, and found that the abuse that Nikki had suffered was undetermined, something that is inexplicable in light of not just the evidence that was submitted at trial, but the evidence that was also submitted in the separate DVSJA hearing. Nikki was sentenced to 19 years to life and began her sentence at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, looking at serving at least 19 years and probably a good deal more, since it is the incredibly rare occurrence that the parole board grants release after the first date and the first parole hearing. And the prospects of Nikki serving the rest of her life in prison could not be discounted, even though the time that Nikki did spend in prison, she was a model prisoner. But you're left to the vagaries of the parole board and the extent to which the parole board recognizes the injustice of keeping someone like Nikki incarcerated versus the desire as the prosecution and the judge to punish someone for the fact that a life had been taken, something that Nikki always regretted and showed incredible remorse for.
Garrett, your firm got involved when it was time for Nikki's appeal. Can you talk a little bit about when you first heard about Nikki's case and how you came to be involved?
Sure. So I am grateful to serve as a member of the board of an organization called Sanctuary for Families, which provides services to survivors of domestic violence, traffic women, and deals in a variety of different ways with sex-based violence. And a very talented woman at Sanctuary for Families by the name of Dortchen Liepold, who runs the legal group there, approached me about Nikki's case and asked if we'd be interested in doing the appeal. I think I first heard from Dortchen on April 24th, 2019, right after Nikki had been convicted at trial. And the first step in trying to decide whether we would and could take the appeal was that I asked Dortchen for the trial transcripts. And I read through the trial transcripts, and in particular, the closing arguments, and recognized that Nikki's case encapsulated everything that's wrong with the way the criminal justice system treats survivors of domestic violence. The prosecution was based on every imaginable myth about the impact of domestic violence and the ignorance of the district attorney about how survivors of domestic violence, quote, should act, quote, was just throughout the case. And when we took a further look at the way the case was prosecuted and the way the conviction had been obtained, there really was no choice but to try to correct an incredible injustice. And so we agreed to take the appeal. And meanwhile, Nikki's trial counsel continued with the DVSJA hearing that I mentioned and the sentencing. And then we basically took over right after the sentencing on February 11th of 2020.
So tell us a little bit more about the issues on appeal, Garrett. And I know we can spend, you know, multiple episodes analyzing the issues legally, and there are so many to discuss. But I know that our listeners would be particularly interested in learning a little bit more maybe about the trial court's exclusion of evidence and the decision not to apply the DVSJA and the arguments that you made on appeal.
I think any lawyer in trying to determine issues to raise on appeal starts with gathering the universe of errors that were committed. And here, that universe was gargantuan. And so we read through the entire history of Nikki's case from the very beginning of the night of the shooting. The fact that Nikki was held at the police station overnight while her children were taken away from her, the multiple times she was asked to describe what happened, and she did it all consistently, through really remarkable, I think, efforts to convict Nikki by the district attorney, including depriving her of her counsel of choice, presenting false evidence to the grand jury that indicted Nikki, and moving on from there to the errors that were committed at trial. So after, you know, gathering the universe of the errors, I think what you try to do as a trial lawyer, as an appellate lawyer, is to recognize the task of the appellate court. And most appellate judges are not going to be looking at redoing a lot of the evidentiary weighing of issues that go before a jury. They're not going to be looking to substitute themselves for the decisions of the jury, but they are going to be interested in legal issues. And in particular, they're going to be interested in legal issues that may have more of an impact on just the case in front of them. You also have to look for issues that are describable in clear ways that don't turn on disputed issues of fact. So after going through that analysis, we basically took the multiple errors that led to Nikki's conviction and narrowed them down to five issues that we raised on appeal. The first was that the judge, on the eve of the grand jury, had disqualified Nikki's counsel. Nikki had placed her faith in a very talented woman at the legal aid group, and that counsel had started to prepare Nikki's case, was going to have Nikki testify before the grand jury. And on the eve of the grand jury, the prosecutor moved to disqualify Nikki's counsel on the ground that the public defender's office, not Nikki's public defender, had years ago represented a potential witness on a driving while impaired charge, and that they then could not cross-examine that witness because of the prior representation. The judge bought that argument, disqualified counsel, finding that there was a conflict and that Nikki could not waive the conflict. Both of those rulings were elementary wrong about attorney-client relationships, as we pointed out in the amicus brief that was filed by the Association of the Bar of the City of New York's group that deals with legal ethics, one of the country's leading experts in legal ethics. Their amicus brief pointed out on appeal how badly both the DA and the judge had applied the law. The second issue we raised was the DA's misconduct in front of the grand jury. You know, perhaps getting into a little bit more of the weeds of legal issues than our audience will want to hear. But there's something called hearsay, and that is something that's not direct evidence. It is somebody recounting something that they had heard from somebody else. And it's clear, there's no dispute, that when a DA is seeking an indictment in front of a grand jury, they may not rely on hearsay evidence. And when they do, it's supposed to be my mistake, and they're supposed to give the jury an instruction that the grand jury may not rely on hearsay evidence. The DA did exactly that when she elicited testimony about something that was entirely uncontroversial, which was ownership of Chris Grover's gun box. And when she elicited hearsay testimony, she told the jury that they should ignore it. But when it came time to critical evidence that not only falsely supported the claim of Nikki's guilt, but also questioned her rendition of the events, the DA provided no such instruction. And what she did was that she elicited testimony from a detective that he had heard classical hearsay evidence that the gun that Nikki admitted was used to shoot Grover had been wiped down. Now, the DA not only knew that this evidence was hearsay, but she also knew that the evidence was false, because she had requested a test on the gun. And as is typical with metal surfaces, the test had come back inconclusive that there had been any fingerprints on the gun, something that was irrelevant since Nikki admitted shooting Grover with a gun in any event. And not only did she admit in front of the grand jury a testimony that the gun had been wiped down, both hearsay and false, but that she then kind of doubled down on the misconduct by allowing the detective to testify that the gun had been wiped down with baby wipes, which had been found near the trash can in the living room. Again, you know, knowing that there was no evidence that the gun had been wiped down, and also, you know, specifically asking for evidence about what was used to wipe down the gun when she knew there was no such evidence. So we also raised that, and in fact, we're really quite hopeful that the appellate court would recognize that this was really quite shocking conduct.
The hearing.
You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
The third issue that we raised were evidentiary rulings during the course of the trial that deprived the jury of much of the evidence that would confirm Nikki's story of abuse, including medical reports, the fact that Grover had uploaded to a porn site called Pornhub pictures of his abuse of Nikki, and that when prosecution expert testified that there was no evidence of who uploaded the pictures, the judge prevented Nikki's counsel from asserting her constitutional right to cross-examine witnesses against her by not allowing them to cross-examine this purported expert with evidence that, in fact, Grover had uploaded the pictures. The judge also refused to allow Nikki to strike a juror, saying that she had done so too late. Again, a denial of her constitutional right to use a challenge to a juror. And then finally, we raise the fact that the trial judge had badly misapplied the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act in the first application of the new law in the state, ignored the purpose of the legislature, ignored the three requirements of the statute, and in doing so, prevented the effectuation of the legislative intent. We filed three amicus briefs, one from legislators saying that the judge had badly misapplied the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act, one, as I mentioned, from the City Bar Ethics Committee, detailing how the judge had misapplied ethical laws. And third, one that I think actually ended up being incredibly important, which was not really a legal brief, but one from a collection of agencies throughout the state that provide services to survivors of domestic violence to describe the science of domestic violence and pointing out how that silence was so badly ignored throughout the entire course of Nikki's prosecution.
So there are obviously a litany of potential errors at issue. It appears to be an absolute uphill climb for Nikki at this point. What did the appellate court decide?
Well, you're absolutely right. In New York in particular, most criminal appeals end up in affirmance of the result below. The statistics are, I believe, upwards of 90%. Counsel are typically given 5 or 10 minutes to argue, and you don't have much hope of a reversal. Our appeal was really quite unique. I think even those who regularly practice in the criminal sphere were astounded by the multiple hours of argument that we actually had in front of the panel. There were issues raised about the law. There were issues raised about science. And interestingly, the prosecution was taken to task for something they did, not only in argument, but throughout the course of the prosecution of Nikki. And one of the judges referred to it as dehumanizing Nikki Adamando. After argument in April of 2021, we waited 3 months till July of 2021 when the appellate court reversed the judge's decision on the application of the Domestic Violence Act and resentenced Nikki to 7.5 years from the 15 to life that she had been sentenced. The court gave very short shrift to the other four legal arguments we raised, including not even addressing one of them, but said in their opinion that the trial court had not just misapplied the law, but misapplied the way that survivors of domestic violence should be treated in the criminal justice system, something that, you know, has been used throughout the state and the country to help other survivors of domestic violence. And it gave Nikki some comfort, both in terms of finally someone in the criminal justice system believing her, as well as the fact that her case could be used to help others. So the second department, which is the appellate court that we first went to, said things like, we reject the trial court's methodology, approach, application, and analysis of the three factors that were in the statute. The second department also said the court, again, based this finding on, among other things, an arcane belief and suggestion that the defendant could have avoided the murder by withdrawing. The trial court relied on, quote, antiquated impressions of how domestic violence survivors should behave. The trial court erred by failing to, quote, fully take into account the impact of physical, sexual, and/or psychological abuse. And finally, the appellate court said that it is unacceptable in reflecting the views of a more enlightened society that the legislators saw fit to enact the DV Survivors Act, only to have the court frustrate that legislative intent by applying outdated notions regarding domestic violence issues. It was a very important decision in the history of how our criminal justice system treats domestic violence.
I actually underlined and put asterisks around that language as well. I circled the word arcane several times and outdated notions. And as you said, and the appellate court referenced right up front, this was the first time that they had the opportunity to address the DVSJA. So important that they actually struck that tone when it comes to criminalized survivorship, which I'd like to turn to and talk about a little bit more. That is a term that some of our listeners might not have heard. Can you just briefly explain what criminalized survivorship is?
Yeah, you know, I think there probably is no precise definition for me, and I think for others that I've worked with on these issues. Really, what it means is through ignorance and refusing to accept what science has told us for more than two decades, we take someone who has really been victimized by their abuse and criminalize them and treat them as if the abuse was either never occurred or that it had no impact on the crime for which the survivor is committed. And it's basically proceeding to convict someone in the criminal justice system without taking into account really the critical facts of the case that is in front of the system.
Looking at the appellate court's decision and thinking about Nikki's case, it really frustrates me to think about how can we educate around criminalized survivorship? Because if you, as you have so aptly described, starting with the grand jury process, the district attorney, the trial court, really having these antiquated notions, and so many others thinking, oh, well, she should have just left. You know, why didn't she just leave? Why did she have to kill him? How do we even start to educate people about this issue?
You know, I think you're exactly right, Jen. It is a process of education. And I've seen it happen in some other fields in which I've been active in pro bono matters. You know, just as an example, the acceptance of people in the LGBTQ plus community has happened over a rapidly period of time in our society. Obviously, we've got a long way to go. But I think through education, it's happened pretty quickly. Here, we need to do the same thing, and I don't think we've done it yet. Organizations like Sanctuary for Families and another wonderful organization called Fearless conduct training programs for prosecutors and judges. There seems to be more openness for people to understand domestic violence and its impact. You know, we know from science that there are conditions of trauma bonding where survivors of domestic violence actually bind to their abusers. We know that the overwhelming majority of survivors continue to have feelings, love even for their abusers, and don't want to leave the relationship. They just want the violence to stop. Typically, after an instance of violence, there is a remorse on the part of the abuser. There are promises that it will stop. There are physiological impacts of domestic violence. There is trauma inflicted on the portions of the brain that affect memory. Survivors of domestic violence regularly suffer from low self-esteem, depression, anxiety. Abusers often appear in public as, you know, charming in public life. Again, you know, one of the myths that happened in Nikki's case was basically an expert who testified that Grover couldn't have been an abuser because people loved him in his community. We know that that's just false. You know, two-thirds of survivors are re-victimized. The odds of sexual abuse double for a survivor who was abused by a child, as was the case in Nikki's case. 20 people in the U.S. are physically abused by an intimate partner every minute in the United States. One in four women experience physical violence, sexual violence, or stalking in their lifetime. More than half of all female homicide victims are killed by a current or former male intimate partner. And 75% of women incarcerated in New York have suffered severe physical violence by an intimate partner. We need to understand these facts. We need to get other people to understand these facts. And I think, you know, Nikki was gratified that in some respects, her case begins to contribute to the dire need to educate people to treat survivors of domestic violence in the criminal justice system as survivors of domestic violence.
When we first spoke, I remember you said to me, Nikki's case epitomizes everything that is wrong with how the criminal justice system treats survivors. And it really strikes me that Nikki's case is one of so many. You know, the New York Times recently reported that there are over 12,000 women incarcerated in the United States for homicide. And we don't know, we may never know how many of them have killed someone who's abusing them. But we also know that Nikki's case, as much as it is not unique, is also somewhat unique in the sense that in her story, she is this educated, white, suburban mother. She had a community of support rallying behind her. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the We Stand With Nikki movement. But there are so many women who do not have the things, let's say, that Nikki actually had, or when they do get released and their sentence might not have been reduced on appeal, they don't go home to housing and a community of support. So I just want to mention, of course, that there are so many other issues around criminalized survivorship when it comes to women of color as well.
No, I think you're absolutely right, but it's certainly something that we as a firm have discussed, and it's certainly something I've discussed with Nikki. She is well aware that, you know, no one will ever know. But if Nikki had been a Black woman without any kind of community resources, she may very well still be incarcerated at Bedford Correctional Facility. Nikki had a wonderful sister who supported her throughout the process, looked after her two children while Nikki was incarcerated, devoted friends who started a group that were tireless at publicizing Nikki's case, at raising funds for Nikki's case and for Nikki. And Nikki left prison to a remarkably supportive community. That is the exception. So many survivors of domestic violence who are criminalized, just the way Nikki was, have no such resources, and they are left to languish in the system. They are released from prison without a home, without a community to support them, without the counseling services they so very badly need after going through the experience that they went through. And it's really a scar on our system. So what can we do? I think there are a lot of things that can be done. I think, first of all, I think people can support the domestic violence agencies in their communities financially and otherwise. There are some terrific agencies throughout the country that fight hard to avoid what happened to Nikki for all survivors of domestic violence. And there's a lot that we can do to support them. And second, I think the private bar has stepped up to do pro bono work in so many areas, from gun safety to death penalty cases to civil rights matters to voting rights. We need to do more in the area of domestic violence and how that happens in the criminal justice system. And we need to be supportive, not just these agencies that provide services, but all of us, whether it be academics and others, in insisting on training of DAs and judges about the impact of domestic violence. And I think these are just some of the ways that we can educate and hopefully move our society forward to treat survivors as we should treat anyone, which is based on knowledge and compassion.
It really stands out as well that We Stand With Nikki movement was just a group of regular people who mobilized and organized and raised those resources to stand behind Nikki, really led by her sister. So you had mentioned her sister, Michelle, had written a book. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and Michelle herself?
Michelle is a remarkably strong human being who took in Nikki's two children into her family while Nikki was incarcerated, did the best that she possibly could to facilitate Nikki playing a role in raising Nikki's children from prison. They spoke regularly on the phone with their children. She visited every weekend. And at the same time, provided a loving, supportive home for the children as best she could. Throughout the course of the years of Nikki being in prison, Michelle wrote a book called Dear Sister, which is remarkable, and I recommend it to anyone interested in the area. It's really more, I think, about Michelle, about their family, about domestic violence, and about how Nikki was criminalized, to use the phrase that we've been talking about, and what the community did to try to support Nikki. It's a compelling story. I think it educates all of us, not just about the criminal justice system, but how families sometimes deal injurious, not helpful ways with raising daughters, of which I have two, and treating victims of abuse.
So you mentioned that you have two daughters, and this reminds me of something that I wanted to ask you about. I've seen the television footage of the day that Nikki came home from prison. That was earlier this year. And I noticed, I said, there's Garrett in the background. So can you tell us what it was like to watch that and to be there? Because I have to tell you, you know, just watching that as a woman, as a parent, I was absolutely in tears. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, we all were.
I see you're affected now, even just thinking about it. I can't imagine.
It was it was a very emotional day. So many people had worked so hard on Nikki's case, and then to finally see it happen, you know, I know from other matters I've heard of that people work equally hard on other people's cases, and it doesn't end up with someone being released to their young children and going home to their small children and having an opportunity to be with their children as they're growing up. I know how important that is as being a father. I know how important it was to me, how important it was to my daughters. And being able to play a part in giving that back to Nikki and giving that back to her children was really quite an emotional day. You know, as you can imagine, we had developed a relationship with Nikki. We visited her while she was incarcerated. And just to see her being reunited with her children and them having an opportunity to try to get on with their lives and right the injustice that had been perpetrated on her throughout really all of her 34 years was really something that's, although I've just tried to, is really indescribable.
Again, you know, looking over my notes for today, and I was looking at your firm biography again, and there's some quotes from your peers who say, you know, if something seems impossible, like this is the guy that you go to. And they're talking about the IP&T space. So I really have to laud you, you know, congratulate you, and just say how important the work is that you did here, because it really did seem impossible, because at each and every step of the way in the legal system, and as you said, Nikki's 34 years leading up to this, it just seemed impossible that she would have walked out of prison earlier this year. So thank you for all that you did.
Well, thanks. I was part of a large group that achieved what we were able to achieve for Nikki, all the way from her community and certainly to her sister, to her children themselves, to my colleagues at the firm who worked on the appeal, to other law firms that worked on the amicus briefs, to people that I've reached out in the community to help me understand things better than I did. You know, I'm still learning. So thank you. But it really was a village that got Nikki home.
As we close, you know, I had started out asking you to tell us a little bit about Nikki's story. And I know you're in contact with her now. Can you tell us how she is now? How is she doing? And how are her children?
Her children and Nikki are remarkable. They, I think, in some respects, as a result of the experience, cherish their relationship in ways that maybe those of us who haven't lived that kind of experience don't do. So in some ways, the days are more real. The days are more meaningful. You know, if you have something taken from you, you appreciate it more when you have it than if you just take it for granted. And that's not to say there haven't been challenges. You know, obviously, being readjusted is a lifelong process. Nikki is getting regular help. But I think knowing that, you know, her close community, knowing that I think it was almost 600,000 people signed a petition seeking clemency and that she had support. And Nikki is finding meaning in supporting other movements in other states to pass legislation like the Domestic Violence Survivor Justice Act and otherwise trying to help other survivors. So, you know, all in all, under the circumstances, the family is doing great. But, you know, there are challenges that will have to be addressed daily.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about Nikki's case and your experience and educating, you know, me and our listeners. This has really been so meaningful and impactful. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you for doing your part in trying to educate people about domestic violence and in many respects, the injustices of our criminal justice system. Thank you.
The Hearing.
Thank you for listening. This is my last episode as a U.S. host before I pass the mic, and I can think of no better way to end than this impactful and moving conversation with Garrett. Of course, I'll still be staying on as a fan and a listener. Please remember to subscribe and send your thoughts, feedback, and ideas for future guests to thehearing@tr.com. That's thehearing@tr.com. Thank you.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.